is an interview with Vern Cook. This is tape 19, side 2. What was the legacy that Wayne Morris left behind?
Well, the only thing, you know, I think about it in long term, he did establish a reputation, whether it's totally true or not, I don't know, of great independence and willingness to stand up for the things that he believed in at the time. And I don't know if you'd call this a legacy, but I think that one of the things, if I were to ever quote Wayne Morris on anything, it would be his view of representative government and his, which I've heard him say, what is the responsibility of a senator or a representative, truly, in, when it comes to public issues? Is it his responsibility to have someone go out and take the poll and then dutifully vote the way the poll shows? No, and that's not his responsibility. His responsibility, according to Wayne Morris, was to be a teacher, to vigorously argue the point of view that he believes is right and proper for the body politic to adopt. Whether the current majority happens to agree with him or not, and then after the debate on the issue, then to let the decision be made as to what the people really are for. And I believe that that's part of the problem that we have today on both parties, and whether in federal or state level, they're always out with their wet finger in the wind, trying to figure out what at the moment people happen to be thinking, rather than providing leadership and providing a principled approach to this, that, or whatever it is, and then taking the chance that they may be rejected because they do take a position on principle. And that's dangerous, but it also is the only thing that I think will bring us really government based on principle. So that's the biggest thing that I remember Morris for. He was very effective in his own way, in a lot of ways, I think. I'm sure he was an effective member of the Senate. And the other legacy, having contributed to Lyndon Johnson's becoming the president, which did bring some really good things here. I often overlook that there was the Civil Rights Act of 64. That was during the Johnson administration. I was just reading the other day, he told someone after the vote, he says, well, there goes the South. We won't get their votes again. he was probably right. And Medicare, I think that came during the Johnson administration. There's some really fine things came with Lyndon Johnson. And of course, he wasn't a man of principle either, but so I guess you can't insist on that if you unfortunately. Other than that, I don't think of any particularly great legacy that Morris left. Have you heard of any?
Well, I guess in terms of your talking about the stands that he took, of course, he's most remembered for his stand against the 1964 Gulf of Tonkin resolution, one of two senators that, it goes back to your discussion of acting on one's principles rather than what's expedient.
Yeah, well, that would fit into that. Now, whether he was right or wrong, I'm not sure. He probably was right, but of course, hindsight's always 20/20. I like to quote, and maybe you have, Winston Churchill in his memoirs was commenting about a particular German general who, very able German general on the Western Front, the Russian Front, made an extremely serious mistake as a result of which he lost all of his armies. And Churchill, in commenting upon this, said, those who have had to make decisions under similar circumstances may feel free to criticize. And so I think that's often the case. Morris may have been right at that time. And it was courageous that he had the guts to take that position.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about the things that you felt you accomplished during your
Well, one of the things that I was very interested in was school support. I was always a strong supporter of local control of schools, I mean elementary and secondary schools, and I always supported funding, usually from the state level, for them. And being from Eastern Multnomah County, and I let it carry over to my Senate career, even though for a period of time I was elected countywide, there was frequently a different interest. The people of the Portland School District number one, where all the wealth was, always wanted to keep it all. And Eastern Multnomah County, which is where my legislative district had come from and where I live, we had all the poor people. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the industry. We had the kids, but we didn't have the industry. Portland didn't have the kids, but it had all the industry. Mm-hmm. And so I consistently, until I was overwhelmed by a Portland juggernaut somewhere along the line, supported legislation that would equalize the amount of revenue available for students at most levels. And also during my legislative career, part of the time when I was chairman of the Senate Revenue Committee, I opposed efforts to destroy local control, and that was a big part of my opposition to the McCall tax plan. And I opposed tax limitations. And as a matter of fact, you know, think of what are the things that could have caused me to eventually lose. Well, maybe someone suggested they people begin to know my positions on too many issues, and it was before they didn't realize. When the first, one of the first, I think it was the first tax limitation measure came out, and it was, there was a kind of a guy that had some mental problems that filed the original initiative, and then my friend Ray Phillips came along and picked it up and got it on the ballot. There was special effort by the legislature, and to Bo's credit, it was made a big focus, and we worked very hard from the legislative level with lots of educational material and showed leadership, and that would have been in 77 or 78, and we defeated the tax limitation measure. Now, I think maybe we defeated it once more when I wasn't there, and then finally the last time they passed it, and I think probably the large reason was there wasn't leadership against it. They were afraid. And so unfortunately, with the McCall tax plan, one of the major reasons, the McCall tax plan in essence proposed to abolish the property tax and substitute the income tax. Well, maybe that's where we're going to get now. So when Measure 5 came along, and I opposed it because it would destroy local control of schools. I thought so then, I think I was right. Now comes Measure 5, which in effect is doing the same thing, and it's destroying local control of the schools. And it looks like it may substitute the income tax for it. So Measure 5 is a backdoor adoption of the McCall tax plan. Although
I've never heard that.
Well, that's what it does, the same thing that the McCall tax plan would have done, only with slightly different sources of financing in a slightly different way. McCall would have completely eliminated, almost completely would have eliminated the property tax.
Of course, we have yet to see whether people are going to endorse a sole income tax as being the sole.
Well, we haven't got that way yet.
Source.
They'd like to have, of course, they being the special interest, big business would like to have a sales tax. And that phoenix is just resting now. It'll rise from the ashes in 2 to 4 years from now.
You think so?
Try it again. Yeah. Big money will never stop trying to get a sales tax because it imposes the burden on ordinary lower income people and relieves the wealthy. That's its primary purpose. Always has been. Always will be.
And you would support what?
Well, income tax changes. I think my chances are probably for between zero and nothing, but we'd be better off if we repealed Measure 5. The property tax is really one of the most progressive taxes we had. It's been much maligned, but it really was the old one before Measure 5. It was based upon your ability to pay. Now, some of it was a capital levy, and it is a capital levy, but that's right, your wealth, and I remember making the argument, it's what you own as well as what you earn. That's the measure of ability, not just how much your current paycheck is. And I also supported the inheritance tax, and I opposed Bob Smith and his ilk when they effectively repealed the inheritance tax in Oregon. Bad legislation. It's certainly contrary to equal opportunity and democracy and trying to have a level playing field, all these nice words. You don't have a level playing field when the wealthy get to keep all their wealth and the poor people start out poor and never have any opportunity to become anything else. I've recently been shocked. I've been interviewing people and got one person to come in my law office to practice with me. I've been shocked to learn these graduates of law school come out of law school owing from $50,000 to $100,000. Shocking to me. I never had any idea it was anything like that.
I'd heard that about a medical school. I hadn't heard that about law school, but
same
it doesn't
thing.
Surprise me.
Same thing. And of course, when I got out of law school, I owed $500 to Dr. Trillinger. Of course, I worked, but so did these others work.
So are you inferring then that that creates a motive on their part to be working solely for money to be able to pay off these huge debts?
You can't. It's one of the difficulties that I'm having in finding the kind of person to come in with me to work without paying them a salary. I want them to come in and start and are living on what they earn. We got this, each one of them, they got these huge debts. I talked to a young man that's not going to come out. He says his parents had helped him and his sister through undergraduate school at private schools, but they couldn't afford to help him once they got in graduate school. And he says, he looks there, I owe $100,000. I think I don't own a sou. I don't own any property. I'm not working, and I owe $100,000 at interest ranging from 6 to 12%. He said he had 15 different loans. And how he thinks, and I think he's right, he can probably get them to hold off, because what are they going to do? What are they going to get if they go after? Can't discharge them in bankruptcy either, you see. They're all non-dischargeable by federal legislation. So you're stuck with them.
I had no idea.
Yeah. So.
Well, going back to summarizing your years in the legislature, are there other things that
was a consistent supporter of civil rights legislation. Again, I can't claim that I was out in the front on these. There were other legislators of both parties that supported this, but I came in on basically the second wave of civil rights legislation in Oregon. The first one were the radical progressives and the Hatfields, the left-wing Democrats and the liberal, more or less liberal Republicans, like Hatfield and some others who were around, that did the first wave. Mm-hmm. And then I came in and supported that sort of thing after that. Then I supported the right to abortion, which I think is a liberal civil rights position. And as I think I told you one time before, I was prepared to support extending the prohibition of discrimination against gays, but I wasn't prepared to become a martyr for a lost cause. So unless as I mentioned to you one time about how we had this meeting of the Senate committee, and I must have been in 79, I was the chair, and there were five Democrats and four Republicans, I think. And so we Democrats met, and one of these Democrats really wanted that bill to come out, and that was Walt Brown. He just called me a couple days ago, and I said, Walt, I will provide the fifth vote if you and all the other Democrats will agree that when it gets on the floor, you'll vote for the bill. Hmm. He refused to do it, and I never provided the fifth vote.
Really? And this was which bill again?
To prohibit discrimination against gays and lesbians. Uh-huh. Now, the next session, when he was still there, he must have done the same thing, only the chairman there wasn't smart enough to catch it. So they got it out, and Walt had supported getting it out, and then on the floor he voted against it, his vote defeated.
Really?
Yeah.
On what basis? What was his rationale?
I don't know what his rationale was. I'm not sure. It wasn't the principal one, I'm sure of that.
What would the advantage be to him of getting it out on the floor but then voting against it?
So he could tell people that he got it out on the floor, I guess. It sounds crazy to me. And don't ask me to explain the rationale of why he did it, but it's sufficient to say that it was the same thing. Had I voted to have it out, I'm sure he would have voted against it. And as it turned out, it wouldn't have made any difference, because I got I got hurt by my supportive gaze anyhow, so I don't suppose it would have made a heck of a lot of difference. But I got sandbagged by McFarland on the gay issue.
That's in your last election when
you were
running.
And so I was, and I think that's a civil right. I mean, I think the last session of the legislature did a miserable job on that, and the Supreme Court ought to throw that bill out. I don't think they've ruled on it yet. I think it's appealed. And they didn't really touch this at the seminar on Friday, but it's an unprincipled bill. This bill that says that they didn't have the guts to just flat out outlaw discrimination. So they pass a bill saying that no local district can pass a measure outlawing it. It's reminiscent of the Colorado measure that's being taken before the Supreme Court, isn't it?
That's
right. It's the opposite side.
Yeah.
Same thing. Huh. And I may be wrong, because you don't know, as Dooley says, the law is what the Supreme Court says it is, but the Supreme Court gets it. They ought to throw it out, because I think it violates home rule. And I think it violates home rule of city and county. That's my view. And the Court of Appeals has ruled otherwise.
So cities and counties should be able to pass whatever laws they want?
Well, perhaps so. Until the state occupies the field. See, that's the other thing that's involved here. It's all, I think the LeGrand case is established. This came up at the seminar too. It was a very worthwhile seminar. Touched a lot of things. Mm-hmm. The LeGrand case, which had to do with state employees' pensions, I think, established that even though the Constitution only specifically refers to the state's right in criminal laws to supersede local laws, mm-hmm. the LeGrand case has held that when the Oregon legislature occupies the field even in civil matters, then anything in conflict with it falls. So, you know, this whole thing reminds me of, I heard a little ditty years ago, and I can't remember how the first lines go, but it says, when you're doing well, you have lots of friends. When you're doing badly, the rats desert the ship. And the final line of it is, when in doubt, do right. Which is a lesson these legislators should have read and understood. Kind of like the old story of the bootlegger. He never paid income tax in all of his life for 50 years. And finally he gets married, got a new wife. He calls up his lawyer accountant and he says, you know, for 50 years, I have never filed an income tax, but now I'm married, I've got religion, I want to start a new life. I'm going to file an income tax return this year. And he says, I've just got one question. The lawyer accountant says, what is that? Should I put down more than I earned, or should I put down less than I earned? And the accountant says, well, why don't you put down the amount you actually did earn? Oh, he says, I never thought of that. So I think that epitomizes this gay lesbian rights bill that the goddamn legislature adopted the last session. Mm. Never occurred to him to do the straightforward, honest thing.
Well, if the federal government occupies the field, then does that preclude any other statements below? I mean, if the Supreme Court comes out very clearly on this Colorado measure number two, amendment number two, does this then tell what the cities and counties and states?
It may.
It precludes their
it may.
Acting
we'd have
on
to,
that.
It may. We'd have to read the, you'd have to see the decision first. You don't know how the decision will actually come down or what the basis of it will be.
Sure.
And I'm sure that if the Supreme Court throws out the Colorado measure, it's going to have significance. Could have significance far beyond gay and lesbian rights. And I don't know. And that's why it might not pass. That's why it might not make it through. Because the Supreme Court, even if five members might be sympathetic, and from what I read, there might be five members. I think Souter, who's a Republican, was speaking rather sympathetically, I saw. There might be five members that would be inclined to throw it out. But they have to figure out a rationale. That's the way the judges do it. They figure out the result they want, and then they try to figure out how they can justify it. So, the difficulty and figuring out how they can justify the decision without screwing up everything else.
Well, we'll see, won't we?
Yeah.
Well, anything else in this category?
Well, in the category of highlights, there were various things. I was always a very hard-working legislator, and I've even had people like Deardorff tell me one time, you know, you're always there, you always spend all the time. I spend a lot of time, and to the neglect of my family, actually, and I like to think of it, I'd like to think of myself in a good light. Plutarch wrote a story of this ancient Roman who, on his death, was a very prominent Roman political personality, did many, 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 many great, great, great things. But on his death, he didn't leave any money for his daughter's dowry, and he was being severely criticized for this. And Plutarch observed that you basically can't serve two masters. You can't serve the people and also serve yourself, usually. And as Bob Thornton once said, if you're in politics and make money as a result of it, you probably should be in jail. So that's my most recent authority. And so I credit that or discredit that to the fact that I'm not a wealthy person. And sometimes my wife says that I neglected my kids, and I may have, in the effort of working so hard at political things.
Did you ever talk to them about that?
Children?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I have a few times, yeah. And of course, I don't know if they really know, and none of them have ever agreed with that, but or said that I did. And who knows? And what is the level of neglect, you know? I mean, Burl talks about hard times. We probably did, but our children never starved, and they always had clothing, and they always had housing. And even if they wanted to go to school, we always helped them. Now, who knows what their inside motivations were and what would have been different if I'd spent more time working in the Boy Scouts and Little League and selling cookies and staying home and playing with the kids more. There's no doubt that the amount of time I had to spend with my children was reduced. As I once heard a priest complaining about the same thing. And I said, it was Father Welsh of St. Aidan's. He was giving this litany about what a sacrifice the priests make, spending all their time serving their parishioners and neglecting their family and on and on and on and on. So I told him it's no different than a member of the legislature or probably the city council. I was talking to someone the other day about this guy that almost got a divorce because he was so involved in the Mason Lodge. He spent 5 or 10 years just working his way up on the Mason degrees, and his wife almost left him as a result of that. People can, or the Elks, I mean, you name it.
Sure.
People can get so involved and think it is so important, enjoy it so much, and other things become secondary.
How would you describe your relationship with the Democratic Party over the years?
It started out a lot better than it's ended up. And I'm not sure why that is, but I was, if I may unhumbly say, I was very influential in the Democratic Party and its organization from the time I got into politics up to maybe 5 years or before.
Are you referring to county or state or?
Both.
Both.
Up until maybe 5 or 6 years before my legislative service ended. When I first got out of law school, I went to law school with the idea that one of the primary reasons I went to law school was because I decided I wanted to go into politics and I wanted a means by which I could support myself. And that's one of the primary reasons I went to law school. I didn't go to law school to become a judge or anything like that. I went there because I wanted a way to support myself while I was involved in politics. And so immediately upon being admitted to the bar, I immediately started, although I was living in Clackamas County originally, I helped sponsor and form a Democratic club called the East Multnomah County Democratic Forum. Well, I got myself appointed to the Clackamas County Central Committee, and then in 53, I helped sponsor the Democratic Club. We formed a group in East Multnomah County, and what was later became the East County Legislative District. I was the first president. We organized it. We were in Edith Green's home at the time that I was elected president, and Betty Shadeen was elected secretary. I became very active in that, and as a result of that effort, I was elected to the legislature. I was very active and influential in the Multnomah County Democratic Central Committee. We elected chairman. East County was referred to at times by some of my detractors as Cook County. We swung the elections of the chairman and vice chairman. We opposed Edith Green and her mafia. We defeated them in organizing the Multnomah County Democratic Central Committee, and I incurred her eternal enmity as a result of that. And this influence continued. I was the president of the State Young Democrats. I was a friend of Dave Epps, who was state chairman at the time that Wayne Morris switched over to Democrat. Based on my experience as chairman of the Young Democrats, I suggested to Dave Epps that we ought to have a state party convention. He thought it was a marvelous idea. He appointed a committee. I wasn't named as the chairman. I was put on the committee along with Carney Bateson, and we planned the first statewide Democratic convention that had been held since the primary election, establishing primary elections in 1911, had been adopted. That was my idea. And we still have these state conventions now. It's in the law and so on. Mm-hmm. I was very active and influential in many ways. That
were you at all active in the National Democratic Party?
Only in the sense that but I was friendly with those who were. When I first started getting involved in politics, Monroe Sweetland was the Democratic National Committee man, and he was friendly to me at the time. Used to go to his home occasionally. I don't remember who the National Committee woman was initially. I was maybe Graham Walker's mother, I think, may have been National Committee woman. Only through my contact with these people, and in course in 1960 and 64 and 68 in the old days, delegates to the Democratic conventions were elected, some of them statewide and some by congressional district. And my first time I ran was in 60, and I didn't win election, but I came close. And then I was elected as a delegate in 64 and 68. Now, that really didn't give me much power, but I was involved in the conventions. Mm-hmm. And I was never involved at the national level, except peripherally through the Democratic Party during the Kennedy administration. Bob Straub, at that time we were friendly, and I don't know what happened to him later, but he named me as registration chairman for the state of Oregon. I was registration chairman when Kennedy was running. But I think because Green was a Kennedy supporter, and I think she poisoned the waters. I met with Bobby Kennedy and remember saying we needed some money to help us in the registration drive, and he sounded friendly, and that's the last I ever heard of the son of a bitch. We never got any help from anywhere on registration or anything else, which was real important then.
Were there other issues aside from registration that you were interested in nationally?
No, that's an interesting observation or question. I never got involved in the Vietnam debate one way or the other. I was kind of halfway supportive of Lyndon Johnson, but I really didn't know. I've always, I'd supported the New Deal type legislation. I was on economic issues and civil rights issues. I was always supportive of those issues, although I never got out in front and led any parades or anything like that on those things. I never went down south to work as a no-fee lawyer. By that time I'd got married, I think, so I probably wasn't even giving it any thought whatsoever. Maybe I would have if I'd been single and not married. I might possibly have, but I didn't under the circumstances. So I can't think of anything really. The reapportionment decision that we got here in Oregon was a precursor of Baker versus Carr, which was federal legislation. Mm-hmm. We did it first, and they followed along afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I was interested in what was happening there. I'm not sure that I took any role in it.
That was the move that brought about single-member districts?
It was the move that required the states to reapportion based on population, mm-hmm. not necessarily single-member districts. And then the same thing that followed, maybe that was another case, that required the states to constitute congressional districts based on population, or close to it. Mm-hmm. Before Baker versus Kerr, the United States Supreme Court had said that it would not involve this because it was a political question, and they wouldn't touch it. They wouldn't do anything. And finally, some